You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, first broadcast on the 22nd of March 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to edition 298 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards.
On the show today, we'll be joined by John Ronson, the multifaceted British writer, broadcaster and journalist with an eye for the odd and unusual, whose latest book looks at the unpleasantly modern phenomenon of public shaming and asks, why now? And for its subjects, why me?
We'll also welcome journalist and author David Henke to the show to hear how Tony Blair makes his voice heard in international politics and keeps the money rolling in to do it too.
And later we'll be making some space for the astronaut James F. Riley, who'll be telling us about his mission spent high above the Earth and what he's also learned about life back down below.
All that, plus Steve Bloomfield will be here to tell us all about the stories that matter for the week ahead. We'll enjoy some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Andrew, it's at this point of the show, normally we would discuss what's happened in the week ahead, but I'm finding it rather hard to concentrate on even things that have passed because I'm so excited about what's still to come in this week's weekly.
I think it's going to be the best show ever, and not just because Robert Bound isn't here. I don't know where he's gone. He's disappeared.
He's absent.
No, maybe. He's doing a story today.
Oh, he's not in the outer reaches of space. I'm just too excited to talk to our spaceman friend.
Yeah, it's quite fun. I saw there was an astronaut coming. I thought, oh yeah, and now actually he's getting nearer. I realise I'm quite excited.
I am definitely excited. Was it one? Did you sort of ever, did the young Andrew Tuck, as he was sort of gambling around the, I don't know, country estate, was he ever thinking one day I could be a?
No, the notion of going into space would terrify me.
That was the same for me.
I'm really petrified. I always had visions of kind of like floating off. I thought, poor astronaut. Like, whoa, not for me. Oh. Gives me shivers.
But maybe we'll get some perspective. I wonder, I imagine James is probably going to be quite a cool customer though, isn't he?
But especially because he goes by initials J.R. As in J.R. Ewing. You can tell he's from Texas, can't you?
What kind of week has it been though, Andrew? You seem quite chipper this Sunday lunch.
I had a long weekend away last week. That was very, very nice. And then this week, it's been a full-on one, including going out on Wednesday night for a quick drink and staying out a bit too late. But that was a bit bad.
Andrew Tuck, I've talked to you about this before.
A lot of entertaining this week.
A lot of entertaining. And then back to the coal face in the week ahead, isn't it?
Yes, next week is production week.
You love that,
don't We've
you?
Finished the first two travel guidebooks for Gestalten. They've gone to... kind of gone to print. We're going to have one more look before they go, but they're done. Next two already being commissioned and sorted out. So in May, you'll be able to buy the London Travel Guide and the New York Travel Guide, both of them in May, and then a couple of months later, Hong Kong, Tokyo. Oh, it's going to be a busy year.
You know, I'm leaving these shores tomorrow, Andrew.
I thought you said you were leaving.
Andrew, I've chosen this forum.
No, I'm that's just a bit of a shock.
Just off for a week, but I won't be around on the weekly, for example, or my other engagements.
Where are you going?
I'm going to Morocco.
Oh, that's good.
It's quite bold for me, isn't it? It's not quite the outer reaches of space, but it's a start. That's what I'm going to be doing next week. What do you think is going to be happening just in the world more broadly, Andrew?
I don't know. Steve, thank you for stepping into the breach.
I'm not sure what I think about this.
This is great. It's Steve Bloomfield in the look-ahead chair.
Last time I was here, I made it very clear I wasn't going to do this again unless I got a jingle.
Oh,
I see.
Yeah.
I thought you looked a bit angry.
Yeah.
We can probably
You and Rob were like, oh, yeah, I'm sure we can do that. I'm sure.
I will sort one out for you. Let's start with some looking ahead at the news, Steve.
Right. So let's do the serious stuff first. Alexis Tsipras, Greek Prime Minister, is going to Berlin. In fact, he's going, not just very, very soon. I think it's even tomorrow he's going. He's going to be on his way to Berlin to meet with Angela Merkel, his German counterpart. They've obviously got rather a lot to talk about, what with the current financial crisis in Greece and Germany's role. Also interesting to see whether he raises this issue that some of his ministers have raised about possible German reparations for everything the Nazis did to Greece.
One imagines
during the
he'll
Second
get
World
fairly
War.
Short shrift if he goes down that track again, but you never know.
Yeah, I'm fairly sure he might just leave that.
I think it's when he first came to power, obviously, one of the very first things he did was, you know, to go to the memorial for people who died during the Nazi occupation. I think it's one of those things. I think he will have a go. I think he's going to bring it out with Angela. That's my feeling. Anyway.
How she responds to that, we'll see.
Interesting.
He's got like 2 or 3 weeks of quite interesting meetings. So he's not only meeting Merkel, but in April he's heading off to Moscow to meet with Vladimir. Well, so again, long as Vladimir actually turns up.
Yeah.
Well, this is it.
And isn't this is around. That in itself will be quite interesting as well. Talking of Putin and leaders who... Bear with me on this segue.
Okay, we're following in your path.
Leaders of whom it could be said have perhaps sort of slightly despotic sort of tendencies. King Richard III is in the news.
Nicely done.
Almost.
You reeled that one back, yeah.
I was going to make some reference to death, but, you know, we don't think...
So this is a gentleman
anymore.
Was found underneath the Leicester car park.
A car park in Leicester, yeah. Well, the funniest thing about this, aside from the fact that he was found underneath a car park in Leicester, this was 3 years ago, they thought, you know, they've been doing some archaeology, mainly because most of archaeology these days isn't about, oh, is this interesting site? Let's see what's there. It's, oh, there's this site that we want to turn into an office block. Can you get some archaeologists in? Just check there's nothing underneath, like, you know, former King of England. And they found him. But since then, there was then this spat between Leicester and York over where his remains were going to go. And Leicester's won. And he's going to be reburied in Leicester Cathedral. That's happening tomorrow as well.
Do you think that's a good thing?
No.
Where would you like to be buried, in Leicester or York?
I think if I'd been dead for hundreds of years,
considered my sort of spiritual home, and this was the question, wasn't it? Where he would have considered, but you know, what is it? 500 and change years later, maybe he should rest where he came to rest.
In a car park.
A car park, literally. It wasn't a car park.
But they're putting him in the cathedral. Well, not literally in the cathedral, but in the grounds of the cathedral. And I think there's something to be said for that.
And they're burying him in a trolley, is that right?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. No, I think they're putting him back in the canal in a trolley.
Okay, fine.
That's how that works. So that's happening tomorrow. That's exciting. Now, Andrew, you were, you know, I mean, obviously...
I was worried when sentences begin with, now, Andrew.
Now, Andrew.
You were what?
No. I'm just saying, you know, you're obviously... a media man of London.
Okay.
But in your time, you're a real media man of London. Okay. Did you ever go to the Ivy?
Oh, yes, I've been there.
Yeah? Were you sort of, you know, in the 90s, it was where, you know, all the media people went?
Well, I don't know. I was there with all the media people. I've been to the Ivy, yes.
Okay, well, you might like to know then that Sotheby's is going to be holding an auction this week for some of the contents of the Ivy. It doesn't say what these contents are. It just says there'll be some contents from the dining rooms. One assumes this isn't food.
Well, I was going to say, it might be a bit past its best.
You don't think it's
might
like
look a bit like
an umbrella that Joan Collins left or
I
something
imagine
like
it'll be
or,
things like that. It's things from the dining rooms and also the VIP areas of the restaurant.
Yes, it could be. Lost and found.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, that would be. If it was like, here's a suitcase that Tom Cruise left here, that might be quite interesting.
Christopher Biggin's underpants or something, yeah. But I don't think I'd
Who
bid
Who did
for
you
those.
Have lunch with at the IV? Really?
That'd be the marquee items in the sale.
Okay. Non-British listeners should Google Christopher Biggins.
I've never seen Christopher
Actually,
Biggins
Actually, they
on
shouldn't. No. They shouldn't. Okay, and just finally, okay, should we go to Nevada?
Please.
Let's do it.
World Clown Association is their national convention.
I hate clowns.
Do you?
Sorry, clowns listening. I don't hate you at all. I do not like clowns.
I don't hate them, but I do.
They scare me.
I find them frightening.
Yeah,
and apparently,
too.
Everyone says, oh, everyone's scared of clowns. And there's pictures, anecdotally, of, you know, children being scared by clowns. Apparently, children love clowns. The fear, it develops later. Where does that come from? I don't know.
Well, look, if you went along to the convention, you could learn basic balloon twisting with Adrian Ravindran.
I need an advanced level course in that by now.
And you're like this, Tom. In fact, I think you can kind of do this anyway. Comedy body movements.
Oh, yeah.
Cyrus Sevier, he's going to be teaching that course. And you're interested in learning any amazing new powder-based makeup techniques?
I know them all already.
Okay, well, in which case then...
Why do you think I look so gorgeous?
You, rather than JT Sykes, should be doing that. I mean, look, I just think, you know, clowning with a partner, or the Monocle Weekly, as we call it. Is this a skit or a performance? Or the Monocle Weekly, as we call it.
Andrew, is it too late to send Tom Reynolds on this course?
No, let's...
Because he has those big clown shoes already. They're his regular shoes.
Well, actually, Robert Bowne would send Matt Allagaier, because he's always... Oh, my God, Matt Allagaier's got such big feet. He kicks my chair every day.
They could both do it. Be clowning... What was it? Clowning in pairs.
Tom Reynolds loves to wear that funny hat. He's a bit like Stan Laurel. He looks like Stan Laurel.
Yeah.
With his hat on. He would love that.
This would be a great story.
Well, there we go.
Okay, let's send them.
Let's do it. There we are.
Off to Nevada.
Who knew? We actually sort of arranged the next issue of Monocle magazine right here. It was a commissioning meeting as well as a news look ahead. I think that's it. Yeah. Honestly, seriously, I'm not doing this again unless I get a jingle.
Okay, we'll get you a jingle. Thank you very much, Steve.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck. Our first guest today is the author, broadcaster, filmmaker and sometime musician and a journeyman into the more unusual territory contained within all those fields, John Ronson.
Ronson has never been deterred from delving into topics that are so current we might not quite know how we really feel about them yet, with best-selling books such as The Men Who Stare at Goats, which explored the US Army's use of New Age techniques, and more recently, The Psychopath Test, which asks whether there's a real little Hannibal Lecter within all of us. Well, Ronson asks questions we never knew we needed answers to, or perhaps just the ones we were hoping we'd never have to know.
His latest book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, looks at the very modern phenomenon of public shaming and how it's been amplified past all previous norms by social media.
John, thank you for coming to see us. Now, the notion of public shaming is at the heart of your book and what happens in the age of the internet. And the stories that you tell, the strange thing is that there many of them are stories that we've seen in the headlines and we've followed a little bit ourselves. And we've kind of, I guess we've been part of the braying crowd.
Yes.
And that's the nice thing about the book. It kind of turns the camera back on our kind of mob-like face.
Yes. It's like, okay, here are the people we destroyed. This is what it looks like to be destroyed by us. Do we want to carry on doing it?
The notion of public shaming, your book makes the point that it was, you know, a wide accepted way of, you know, turning against people who'd done things that were wrong hundreds of years ago, but it has been resuscitated. Why do you think we've grasped it so keenly again?
A lot of it's to do with just the way that social media is set up. So it began in a really great way by giving the silence to voice. And it was a very powerful thing when social media first started. It's like, oh my God, all these people who didn't have a voice had a voice and it was eloquent, that people were funny and passionate. And then when the old media acted in the ways that the old media would act, like a Daily Mail columnist would, you know, write something, you know, brutally homophobic about somebody, suddenly, you know, people had a voice and could do something about it. And we attacked and it hurt them and it was great. And that aspect of things, I think, continues to be great. But the problem is, for a number of reasons, I think we just fell too much in love with attacking people. And so we started attacking people who didn't deserve it. We stopped punching up and we started punching down. And I think one of the reasons is the technology of the internet, that we surround ourselves with people who feel the same way we do. So we just approve each other. So when a kind of frenzy starts, everybody's approving each other. And so that will, you know, that's the wind behind a frenzy sail, I suppose. It's what my friend Adam Curtis calls mutual grooming. And indeed, not only, you know, is that sort of powerful, but also if anybody has the courage to get in the way of it, they get destroyed. Helen Lewis from the New Statesman reviewed my book a couple of days ago, and she said that when the whole Justine Sacco furore happened, the woman who tweeted the ill-advised going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white. She, when all this unfolded, thought, hang on, I'm not sure that was a racist tweet. Surely it was somebody mocking privilege as opposed to flaunting it. And she tried to say something and she was just screamed down. It's like, oh, well, you're just a privileged bitch yourself. And so she shut up.
And what's extraordinary in your book is the people who talk about Justine Sacco, the people who are commenting on it. You know, many of the people who were part of her downfall, there's still a sense of glee. What's interesting is many of the people you go and you don't confront, but you bring them back into the tale and you remind them what happened to these people. You see a certain sense of remorse, a certain queasiness about what happened. But with the Justine Sacco thing, it's still, she hasn't gone back to a normal life even yet in the narrative of your book. You know, she's headed in the right direction. But there are still people, even when she's potentially getting a job for the first time, waiting in the wings to try and drag her down again.
Yeah. Actually, it's now, 15, 16 months since she pressed send on that tweet. And things are better for her now. And in fact, she wants me to tell people that things are better for her now, and they are. She's dating again, she's got a new job. And my book was extracted in the New York Times, and it was the Justine Sacco story that got extracted. And that really helped her too, because, you know, suddenly people were saying, oh my God. Well, I was about to say, people saying, oh my God, look what we did to Justine Sacco, it was wrong. But of course, nobody said that. What people were saying was, look at what you did to Justine Sacco, it was wrong. And I noticed somebody on Twitter said, as if, you know, all you people retweeting John Ronson's book extract, as if you weren't the fuckers who did it to start. dealt with.
John, let me ask you, is there a fundamental problem though that you talk about this sort of the history, you know, the tradition, if you like, of the public shaming and how it's had this resurgence in the social media world? Is there a problem that people actually enjoy that vitriol? They like being a part of it. You said they have these loose alliances which they take strength from. Do people just enjoy it? Is that a fundamental problem?
It's a really interesting question. I think people do enjoy it, but they enjoy it for cognitive dissonant reasons. If they thought about, I mean, I don't want to sound like some kind of patrician moralist, but if they thought about why they enjoyed it, I think they would start to, you know, question whether they should be doing it anymore. So part of the reason why they enjoy it is because they don't want to look in the face of the person they've just destroyed. Like if you ask somebody, like the people who tore apart Justine Sacco, how do you think she is now? They will either say, oh, well, I'm sure she's fine, because we don't want to feel that we're bad, destructive people. Or we'll say, well, I don't care how she is. She's a racist or a sociopath or whatever. Not many people called her a sociopath, but that is a word that's used. And it's kind of, I mean, without wanting to sound too sort of grandiose, it's kind of what Nazis did to the Jews. You know, it's what people do when they want to destroy somebody. They dehumanise them. And nowadays we use words like, yeah, sociopath or whatever. So, you know, I like to think that we are good people. And in fact, our reason for destroying Justine Sacco is because we see ourselves as good people doing a good thing. But if we are confronted with the actual consequences of our actions, you know, the drone strike operator actually seeing the destroyed village, then we would stop enjoying it quite so much.
I think the point that she makes, and another story I just want to touch on, which is, I think, an amazing story in your book, for I'll explain why I think for a different reason. But what's interesting is she points out that these are the kind of jokes that you go and see the Book of Mormon or something. Mm. You'd see these jokes 1,000 times and people laugh and walk away and they realise there's a bit of irony or a bit of nuance behind it. But here she was trying to say something kind of in that world, but she didn't, as she says, I'm not a comedian. I wasn't setting out to do something right for Africa. So I got judged in a very kind of brutal, harsh way. But the strange thing is that it's really minute bits of humour undo people. And I think that, the tale where this woman, Adria Richards, is at a tech conference and she hears two guys make a slight jokey innuendo to each other, a double entendre about a piece of tech hardware. She turns around, takes her photograph. Within minutes, they're escorted, because it goes to social media, they're escorted out of the building, and their lives unfold. Jobs are lost. But the strange thing is the repercussions for her are awful as well.
Yes. So she tweets their picture without telling them, calls them out. And actually, they weren't escorted from the building. They were escorted into a meeting room and asked to explain themselves. And then the conference said, OK, that's fine, we understand. And then they decided to leave the building because they're nerdy and, you know, like me, you know, we're not good with confrontation. So they left. And then they realised that she'd publicly tweeted this. And, yeah, one of them was fired the next day. This happened on a Sunday and he was fired on the Monday. And, yes, then she was brutalised because all we can think to do, you know, in this kind of shaming obsessed society we've created for ourselves, is what do we do with an inappropriate shamer? We shame them. And she was shamed worse than they were. I mean, she still doesn't have another job. She got rape threats and death threats not to leave home. And yeah. And I think the people who shamed her probably came from a place of being shamed themselves. It's like dodgy builders covering cracks with, you know, dodgy cement.
Because in some of the stories, there's a real misdemeanor. There's a tale of plagiarism we can talk about as well. But in this instance, it was such a banality. Mm. And probably within that audience and within the world, they point out that she'd made a kind of, I think you point out that there was she'd made a penis joke herself on her own Twitter feed, but days before. Mm. That why is it that suddenly, that catches fire in that way? The same with, the Justine Sacco story. I'm sure that people say ignorant things about AIDS every day. Why does, the brush fire get behind some stories and others?
I think a lot of the times it's out of the wheelhouse of the person being shamed. I'm sure the fact that Justine Sacco was a kind of blonde, good-looking, sassy New York sort of woman who looks in her pictures like a sort of party person, it's prejudicial to some people, this kind of privileged blonde PR woman, some people just don't like that. So, some people brought her down for that reason. I mean, misogynists brought her down for that reason. It was a kind of perfect storm with Justine Sacco. With Hank, the guy who whispered the dongle joke to the guy sitting next to him, you know, he became representative in Adria's eyes of the gender imbalance in the tech industry and the fact that he was privileged and so he had the right to whisper a dongle joke, you know, whereas what about the very, very few women in the room, you know, and so on. So she found him inherently offensive, I think, because of, you know, what he represented. And the same thing happened to her. I mean, men's rights groups considered her to be kind of, you know, horrific that she robbed this man, this woman, you know, robbed this man of his employment. You know, we must punish her, you know, with rape threats and death threats. So all of these people become like metaphors for other groups of people. Blank canvases. And in fact, this is, I think, what Hank said to me at one point in the conversation. I didn't put it in the book. He said, well, I was a blank canvas for people to put their ideology onto.
John, I was just going to ask you, I mean, we know that you're sort of a prolific sort of, you know, tweeter, you're very, you're engaged with these mediums. When you see these stories, I mean, we shouldn't conflate the medium and the message. Obviously, that's an easy trap to fall into. But do you ever sometimes look at these stories and see how they unfold and see that kind of brush fire that Andrew's describing and think, do you know what, I don't want to be a part of this platform. There's too many risks. There's too many overreactions, people willfully misinterpreting things. It's not a forum where I can use my normal rational processes that I bring to the pages of the books I write. I'm just going to leave it behind. Or do you never think that?
No, I do think I have to be a little bit more bland sometimes, definitely. I've paused a few times before making a point, you know, because I understand that context and nuance don't go down brilliantly on Twitter. And I think all this is a real shame because I remember, here's something I think people don't quite understand. The people who don't like what I've written about Justine Sacco, because, you know, I had my own sort of mini shaming where people were like, oh, what racist is Ronson going to put his cape on for next? And so on. And I think what those people don't understand is that, you know, I think people assume, you know, understandably, that the reason why I wanted to write about Justine Sacco is because I empathise with Justine Sacco. Actually, that's not true. I empathise with the people who destroyed Justine Sacco because I loved the sort of egalitarian social justice power of Twitter in the early days. The reason why I find the whole Justine Sacco thing so horrendous is because it's like it's our people. It's us who destroyed Justine. And I still harbour that kind of great love of Twitter. The thing I love most about Twitter, though, is the fact that how it used to be this kind of radical de-shaming place. Like people would confess their sort of hitherto shameful secrets. And everybody would go, oh my God, I'm exactly the same. And it was like a sort of de-shaming Garden of Eden. And I watched this unfold in the early days of Twitter. And I thought, this is like, I'm going to be like emotional for a second. I thought this is like one of the most beautiful things I have ever seen. You know, this is like an amazing, and then it just blew up in our faces. And the reason why I still love Twitter is because, you know, you still find bits and pieces of that. And people are eloquent and funny. And if I'm having trouble in real life, sometimes I go on Twitter and I see funny strangers being funny to each other and that cheers me up. So I'm not going to come off Twitter because the snake is in the Garden of Eden, but they're still, I just end that metaphor. End that metaphor however you please.
And tell me, you know, the chance of these people, you know, when you contact these people, many of them are very cautious about talking to you. Yeah. And then when they do talk to you, you know, they even warn you that just an association with them could destroy you.
Yes.
And they're like contemporary lepers. You know, they've been pushed out of society and they're aware that they carry some kind of tarnishing, some, you know, some ailment that could be passed on.
Yes.
A really, really bleak. But do you feel that there is a path back for these people?
Well, because, and I completely agree with just with everything you said. I mean, it's a terrifying book, I think, and you know, fear imbues the book. Partly because what happened to these people is the thing I fear the most would happen to me, and that makes me realise that, you know, we are punishing people with the punishment that we are most terrified would happen to us, and I think that's untenable. And so I, you know, logic would say that can't go on. You know, we as human beings cannot carry on punishing people with the thing that we are most terrified of. I mean, you know, the Stasi ceased to be, it ate itself from within, you know, so maybe our Stasi will have to cease to be.
At the very beginning of the book, you know, there's a gentleman called Jonah Lehrer who became a bit of a course celeb in a book he'd written. He'd kind of made up quotes about Dylan and he got caught out. But, you know, one of the things he then gets caught out for is even retelling some of his jokes again in two columns.
Yeah.
Well, that's, you know, I think in British journalism, I see the same journalists making jokes all the time.
Yes.
I've got limited supply as well. But I just wondered if you felt that someone was going to go through all your columns and see if you'd ever said the same joke twice.
Yeah, and you know what? I mean, yeah, one of my big heroes from when I was starting out was Victor Lewis Smith. And the number of times he said, I could count the number of times, blah, 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 on the fingers of a mitten. I mean, I read that Victor Lewis Smith joke about 400 times. And yeah, I thought to myself, oh, come on, Victor, come up with a new joke. But, you know, I wasn't going to shame him for it. And actually, there's a couple of lines in my book, The Psychopath Test. This is a sort of, I'm going to tell a story in favour of what's called self-plagiarism. There's a couple of lines in The Psychopath Test where I'm talking about how bankers and CEOs got away with it for so long. I said, because, you know, if you want to get away with wielding true malevolent power, be boring, because us journalists love writing about eccentric people, you know, because we want to look good. So I wrote that in The Psychopath Test, and that's one of like the most quoted lines in The Psychopath Test. I'd put those couple of lines in a previous thing I'd written, and it was completely ignored. And I thought to myself, God, you know, that's such a smart thought of mine. How come nobody's noticed it? And so when The Psychopath Test like came to the, you know, to that moment, I thought, I'm going to take those lines and put them in The Psychopath Test. And you know, far from feeling ashamed, I felt I was being resourceful. It's like when a band brings out a single and nobody listens, and then they bring it out again a couple of years later and it goes to number one. I mean, that's not shameful, that's resourceful.
John, thank you so much for coming on to the Monocle Weekly. That was, of course, John Ronson, and the book is called So You've Been Publicly Shamed.
Time for some music next up on the programme. We've been talking, Andrew, about the do's and don'ts of social media. So how about a contemplative classic for you next? This is New Order with, appropriately, Regret.
And that was Manchester's finest, New Order with Regret. We'll be talking about Tony Blair next.
In a competitive and ever-modernising world, artisan producers are staying resilient and challenging mass production. Monocle Films visits entrepreneurs in Istanbul, Cape Town and Mallorca who champion the art of craft.
The biggest focal point is, how can I make this thing as hardy as possible? All these materials over time will just soften and darken and start picking up blemishes and start telling their own story.
Making a Point, premiering now in the film section of monocle.com.
Now we turn our eye to a political giant, but one whose role on the international stage since leaving the top job in British politics in 2007 has been increasingly opaque.
We're talking, of course, about Tony Blair, who's departing his post as Middle East Special Envoy for the so-called Quartet. That one was always a controversial appointment, in that Blair's decision-making in the region, along with that of George W. Bush, is seen by some as one of the causes of the unrest that now consumes the region from Syria to Libya. He's been described by one US official as a standing joke in the region.
So how do you keep a political juggernaut or a runaway train, perhaps, like Blair's on track? You need a lot of money, and Blair has balanced his peacekeeping duties with a lucrative line in PR consultancy, sometimes for questionable regimes. Well, joining us now is the journalist and author David Henke, the co-writer, along with Francis Beckett and Nick Cochran, of Blair Inc., a new book looking at how Tony Blair stays in business.
David, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. I wanted to start off, actually, maybe by asking you about that sort of envoy's role. It's been controversial. I wonder, there is a bit of a blurred line, isn't there, between whether it's a... I mean, he's often referred to as a peace envoy, but in fact, some of his remit is rather wider. It includes these sort of business notions. Do you think that's part of the problem, perhaps, with that role in particular?
Yes, I think it is, actually. I mean, he is actually, in one sense, an economic envoy, in the sense he was supposed to try and get Palestine on its feet again. The controversy really sounds about the projects he's supported. And one of the really exciting things we discovered when we did this book was we used the US Freedom of Information Act and basically got hold of a letter between Tony Blair in 2009 and Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, in which, for the first time, you can see on quartet-headed notepaper, Blair's sort of priorities. And it was rather fascinating because he had two key priorities in this area. One was a new rival mobile phone network for the Palestine, and the other was a brand new town near Ramallah. And what was interesting was that Blair, I must say, completely says he has no knowledge of this at all. The one thing he was promoting was the one thing that was bankrolled by J.P. Morgan, which under another hat through Tony Blair Associates he was working for. He says this was what the Palestinian Authority wanted and it had nothing to do with it. But the letter, what is interesting in the letter, it really promotes this. And the other, this new town, was basically for what the Washington Post described as upwardly mobile Palestinians. And they aren't thousands of those, but they are some. And basically, again, this was funded by Qataris and a very wealthy millionaire Arab. And you basically felt that Blair was, in one sense, he's quite rightly promoting, you know, Palestine to get on a better economic footing. But on the other hand, there are enormous beneficiaries for his other role through Tony Blair Associates in representing companies. And at some stage, you know, I mean, he meets the Emir of Kuwait, and at one stage he's supposed to be as part of the quartet. But at the same time, it's quite clear he seems to come away with a large consultancy arrangement for Tony Blair Associates under another hat. And I think one reason why Blair has come under enormous criticism, no one knows where his role as economic envoy and promoting peace and prosperity stops, and where Tony Blair Associates' money-making activity starts.
So, David, for you and this book, what's the heart of the criticism of Blair, then, that he muddles these two roles? Do you feel that if he had left public office and become a businessman, then this would have been acceptable? Or do you feel if he had left public office and only donated his time to good causes, it would have still been fair for him to be involved on the international stage? That's the bit that listeners may worry is, you know, that in the end, I guess people do go on and do something else. He was a very, very young prime minister. He's going to go and do something. He's not going to go and retire to the Cotswolds and sit by a fireplace.
No, and actually, I think I can give you two good examples of this. I think if he had done either, it would have been okay. John Major, the person he defeated, the British Prime Minister he defeated, has had a career in business. And basically, I met him when he came to the House of Commons Press Gallery to give a talk. And he said to me very clearly that he wanted a career in business, but he made sure that he wasn't involved in any negotiations with the British government because people would see this as a potential conflict. Gordon Brown, who followed Tony Blair, basically has devoted his life to charitable good works in Africa, particularly in education. And again, has not combined this with a business role. And both men were comparatively young. Both really, no one is running around. I mean, there is no massive coverage in the UK saying John Major's a bad thing or Gordon Brown's a bad thing because they're doing something afterwards. Blair has really hit this problem that he has confused this. And also, the public gets suspicious if someone sets up a series of companies, which is what Blair has in the UK, that you can't find out where the money comes from and who is donating what or who his business clients are. They're all secret. Whereas if it was John Major, you know who's paying him. It's quite clear. It's a commercial arrangement. And basically, people have seen him. They don't blame him for wanting to enrich himself, buy houses for his children and all that. But they do think that the way he has gathered money, the secrecy behind it all, and the fact he runs two charities as well as being envoy, he runs one with the Faith Foundation and the other is to do with African governments. Both these organisations are supposed to be totally independent from him and raising money charity. And he claims that the money he gets from the sort of questionable regimes goes in for all these good works. But we discovered in the book that something, say, like the Faith Foundation also receives large donations from people. So there seems to be a slight conflict. And what we do notice is that Blair move from the time he was prime minister. There's a great quote from his wife, Cherie, saying when they bought this very expensive house in Connaught Square, it was, they had a mortgage the size of Mount Snowdon, one of our biggest mountains in the UK. But suddenly, if you check, within 2 years, there's no mortgage problem. They even got the money to buy a muse house at the back of it. And now it is worth about, I mean, it's gone up in value from when they were here, but it's worth now about £8 million.
I just wonder, though, David, it's interesting to reflect on the thing that Andrew mentioned there, this sort of unease, particularly from the electorate in this country, about our politicians. It seems once they move on, certainly from the highest office, there does seem to be a bit of an unease about them doing very well. And this was rather a problem, wasn't it, that did dog Blair in office. People suggested he had too easy a relationship with money. There was comments that he and Peter Mandelson had made, you know, when Labour was still in office in this country about their, you know, an easy relationship. They didn't have a problem with people doing well. Do you think it's a personality thing? Is he dogged personally by this beyond just a representative of his office? It reflects a broader unease people have had about Blair's attitude to money, perhaps, that goes back over, I don't know, a whole one political generation.
Well, I think it's both Tony Blair and Cherie Blair as well, who's also making a fortune as well through various businesses, basically seem desperate to acquire as much wealth and money as they can. And you think, well, do you have to really go to this area? Of course, Mandelson is famous for the quote, which he's partly retracted, that he was always relaxed with the filthy rich. In fact, Mandelson, we discovered, has the most, he has a house that's worth even more than Blair's top house. It's worth about £11 million.
But does that, just wonder though, Dave, does that really matter? I mean, Mandelson's house is worth £11 million, Tony Blair's house is worth £9 million. Does that materially matter? Okay, they're big numbers and a lot of people in this country, that's beyond their sort of, you know, expectations, whatever, for their own personal wealth. But for a lot of people, that's small change. Do you think some people would say, well, look, we should be more sanguine about this? In the US, they have a much more relaxed attitude about how much money Bill... People really don't talk about how much money Bill Clinton
makes. I was going to say, I think Bill Clinton, I looked up, has made... He's made $100 million in the last 4 years, according to many records. Far more than Blair. Why is it that, you know, the liberal left in this country is not cross with Clinton in the same way that they're cross with Blair? I wonder whether these criticisms come out of a feeling on the left that they were let down by Blair, that Blair wasn't one of them, that we're done with the new Blair experiment. Do you feel that there's kind of added opprobrium for him because, of course, this isn't good and it's murky and it looks complex, but it also sits next to a track record which, you know, both on the left and the right is not appreciated anymore?
I think there is something, because he was actually one of the most successful prime ministers in the sense that he won huge majorities and he bridged basically the left and the central ground. So the left, in one sense, don't like him because they feel he betrayed some of the principles of the Labour Party. Because, I mean, after all, a lot of the things that are going on now under the coalition, such as the introduction of some competition and privatisation in the National Health Service, the creation of academy schools, started in a small way under the Blair government. But he also, I think it's not only the left, the right hate him because they think he should have been a Conservative. They can't understand why on earth.
Well, you're saying, it's funny, your book is being appreciated, you're saying, in the UK, both by the Daily Mail, as you know, for a mainstream newspaper as far right you can go, and the Guardian and the Independent on the more liberal left. So your book has united all of these these voices.
I think that's true. And there is this thing. And also there is a sort of, in America, you get the feeling that people think, oh, well, so-and-so's done really well. It's gone on with it. That's great. In Britain, this is a slight social view that's different to America in the sense that people don't, they do worship businessmen and think are brilliant. I mean, Richard Branson, good example. He's quite a hero in Britain for setting up all sorts of new things. But they also have, I think the public, including some of the right-wingers, the more patrician Tories, have quite a social conscience. And they actually think that someone who's nakedly making money all the time. And after all, someone has said the one thing that's completely different from America and Britain is the National Health Service, which, as someone has sometimes said, is the British equivalent of the British religion. The idea of something available to everybody, regardless of their means or anything they will get treated. And that is quite different to the attitude in America, where they seem to think for quite a lot of people should, you know, well, they haven't got the money to do it, and so it's partly their fault and so on. So I think Blair also, I picked up, is quite envious of Clinton. Because Clinton is much wealthier than all.
David Henke, there, I'm afraid we must leave it. The book is called Blair Inc. It's by David, Francis and Nick. Terrific read. David, thanks for coming to tell us all about it.
Thank you.
Up next, we're going to be talking to none other than astronaut James F. Reilly. Stay tuned.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Now, as much as going into space is about rockets, gravity-defying feats, and more than a little daring do when spinning in a tin can 400 kilometres above the Earth, much of the work that goes on in orbital craft, such as the International Space Station, is scientific. Small, day-to-day experiments that, when performed in zero gravity, might turn perspective on its head and open up new ways of thinking about life back on Earth.
A man who's performed more than his fair share, it's safe to say, of space-based experiments is the astronaut James F. Reilly, the Texas-born geologist who from 1998 to 2007 took part in three space missions spanning from the old Mir space station to today's more accommodating ISS. James is in the UK to inspire young people to think more about what's going on above their heads and maybe plant a few ideas inside those minds too. James, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Great to have you here at Midori House with us. There's obviously so many questions I want to ask you about your space travels. But I wanted to ask you, first of all, about that journey, I guess, from being a geologist and sort of searching for oil and gas, which is sort of what you were doing before, into space. How did that come about? Was it an ambition you'd always harboured, or did someone say, do you know what, you'd be rather good as an astronaut? How does something like that happen?
It was, I was like many of us, in that I always wanted to be one from the time I was about 8 years old. And John Glenn was actually on his first mission, and I was sitting in a dentist chair in Vancouver, Washington, where we lived at the time, and the dentist was fascinated. There's a human in space, you know, and he was talking about that. And at that time, they didn't have satellite communication, so they had to wait for John to come into ground coverage. And when it did, for 10 minutes or so, they could talk to him. And they broadcast it out on the radio. And the dentist went over and listened to it. And after one of these passes, he came back. And I'd been laying there, obviously, for about 10 minutes. And he said, do you think you'd like to be an astronaut someday? You know, he was just flabbergasted by this concept. And of course, I'm laying there, an 8-year-old kid with all that stuff in my mouth. All I could think about was anywhere but here, you know, but it stuck. And that followed all the missions all the way through Apollo and into Apollo Soyuz and then the beginnings of the shuttle program. But the Navy, when it came time to become a fighter pilot, test pilot, astronaut, which was my big plan, Navy didn't need fighter pilots about halfway through my college career, so that was sort of a big life-changing moment. Found out I liked geology, so I pursued it, and ended up getting me down to the Antarctic, where I spent 4.5 months out in a remote field camp doing field work. So got a chance to do a lot of really cool stuff, but in 1985, I realized some of these folks are civilians, and so I applied. And they were very gracious when they said no. They said no 8 years in a row, and then they finally called me in for an interview in 1994, and then I was very honored to be called to be part of the 1995 class of astronauts, which was the 15th from the original seven, which included John Glenn.
It's a shame that we don't actually for once have a webcam, because you do look like an astronaut, I must say. First of all, there's something about your demeanor. I'd trust you up there. And you have the perfect NASA jacket on. You have a space tie. We believe that you're the real McCoy.
I was going to ask actually, I guess to reflect on that, did you find that some of the skills and disciplines that you had, did you have the skills that you then put into practice in space already? Was it an innate thing, or did you have to acquire these? What was that process like by the time you got to sort of mid-1990s and you realised this was going to happen? Is it sort of starting learning it again, or is it building on, you know, facets of your skills you developed over many years?
There was some element of that, of course, but now one of the other things, they train us a lot, you know, so we start basically from the beginning and learn everything we need to know from a technical aspect. But one of the things is, which is more indirect, but really more into the sort of the personality type, was that I recognized that I'm now in the company of overachievers. And so I really had to step up my game, you know, to just meet their expectations. which drove me to being very efficient and correct some of the bad habits that I'd gotten into over most of my adult life. And they really helped me pull myself up by literally my bootstraps and being able to compete with my peers.
Jim, you've brought in a few things to show us. A pair of gloves here.
Yes.
Tell us about these.
Okay, so one of the questions that I know always comes up is, what are the things that you have to do in space and their skills that you have? And one of the more difficult ones is trying to achieve what we would normally do here on the ground, but having to do it in an environment that's really foreign to you. And when we do the spacewalks, the suit and everything is actually very bulky. So you're now about twice your normal size. Everything you're doing is very difficult, and you have to learn a new way of doing it. And so instead of just reaching up, for example, to touch something that might be over your right shoulder, you can't really do that in the suit without fighting the suit, and that'll wear you out over time. So you learn to turn and do different things and make sure you're, again, play to your strengths, figure out what works well in the suit and what doesn't. And so one of the things that I did as an instructor when we had folks that were coming in to do the spacewalk training for the very first time is before we ever even got into the suit, I would give them a little challenge, and I thought you guys might be able to try this one out. So
I'd like to think I'm up for a challenge.
Okay,
let's give it a go.
Okay, so here's a glove for each of you. Okay. So obviously one hand versus the other. Are either of you right-handed or both?
I'm right-handed.
Oh, so both are right-handed. Okay.
It's okay. We're gonna do it. One of us need to put it on the left hand, really.
Actually, that's fine. This will be a challenge. We'll see who's better at this.
Okay.
Right, so, and what I'm going to do is, I've got coins here.
I wonder what those coins are for. I thought you were going to tip us at the end. Well, that's a nice guess.
Okay, so what I want you to do is just pick the coin up with the gloved hand. You can't use the other hand at all.
Okay.
Just pick up the coin with your gloved hand. And you can pick any of the three that I've got here. There's a 10p coin and a penny and a 1 pound coin.
Okay,
so
fine.
You can go for the thick one if you want, if you think you're
that was good. That was my immediate instinct, my competitive drive. And you go first, Andrew.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Oh yes. Confounded thing. This is less the same. Oh, so we've put the coins on a piece of wood now, which
I managed with the chunky 1 pound coin. I just about managed. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So let me give you the 10p here.
Okay. Let's try that.
Let's try that one.
Be careful. This gentleman will have your money in his pocket in no time.
Yeah, I noticed the 1p coin disappeared.
Okay, it is almost impossible to pick these things up.
Okay, I'm with defeated
mitten.
By that. I was going to try rolling it to the side and easing
and,
it.
And we must point out, these are not space gloves. These are
just regular old gloves.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Okay, so now, right here, do that same thing, but put your finger on the top of the coin and put your thumb right there. Now just slide in.
Yes. So if we slide it off the piece of wood using an edge. And this is the technique you have to use when you're in space, I presume.
Actually, the only lesson there is really you have to think about doing things differently.
Okay.
Right. There's the usual way we do almost everything, and that is, just pick it up, right? Because that's what I asked you to do. But when you actually have to do it, you'll find that doing it the way we normally do it here on the ground is oftentimes impossible. That's the real lesson there.
We wanted to actually shed a little more insight into some of the experiences once in orbit and in space. Now, I think we've got some food stuffs, and our intrepid producer, Tom, is going to bring that in to us now. We might ask you about that as well.
Can I ask you a slightly tougher question while we're waiting for the food to come in? Because, again, Mr. Edwards here is likely to snaffle this. But tell me, the first time you were in space and you go out of the space station to do a spacewalk, an element of fear, an element of caution, because if it was me, I think I would be petrified.
Actually, the thing that was sort of amazing, and I'll actually start from the launch, because I expected to be quite nervous actually on the first one. You'd think that 3.5 million pounds of high explosive that you're strapped to is going to be something that focuses your attention and might get you a little nervous. But it turns out that on the day of launch for STS-89, on my first one, the night before, we actually go out to the pad, just the crew, just ourselves, and it's our opportunity to just kind of look up at this vehicle and think about what we're doing. And I was doing the same thing that I used to do with submersibles, and that I'd look at it and, well, what could happen? And you walk through and catalog all the risks. And basically, 90% of the things there are things that we're trained to respond to and can correct it. And then there's that last bit, you know, and about 10% of the things that could possibly go wrong that you just don't have anything you can do about, and it's just a bad day. So I was sitting there thinking about that, and a young man came over, and he was part of a team that looked for ice on the outside of the vehicle before we launched, and he came over and said, we want to just let you know that you're going to have a 100% safe bird tomorrow. We're going to make sure of it. And I was just floored by that. And then so the next day I was thinking about him and realized he's really speaking for literally the hundreds of folks there at NASA that were working on the program to make sure it was as safe as it could possibly be. And then that became much easier to accept all those other risks that were left. And when I went out, I was actually not nervous at all. And the spacewalk has to be, by the time we get there, we've practiced so much on the spacewalks that we're thinking about all the details. And that's what I was thinking before I went out on my first one. And so I'm thinking about, you know, here's what we're going to do. This is what I'm going to do first. I don't want to get behind here because if I am, it's going to impact here. And we literally had an 8.5-hour spacewalk down to 5-minute blocks. And we knew exactly where things were going to be and where each of us, the two of us that were going outside to do the spacewalks, where we were going to be, where the arm was going to be, and all of these things. And so I'm thinking about that, thinking of all the things that could go wrong. What would we do about it? And that type of thing. And so I was thinking of the details. I imagine it's like being up for a championship match, you know, and you're thinking about every possible thing, what your opponent, and our opponent, of course, was the environment, what's happening, what's going to happen, and thinking about all that stuff. And as I was doing that, you know, the one thing that I was completely focused on was not failing. I just didn't want to fail. So I didn't want to start out behind. That would probably be the only thing I would say that I'm afraid of is failure, and that's probably fairly characteristic. Well, my wife, of course, but she's not here, thank goodness. So that was what I was thinking of. And then Yuri Usachev, who's the commander of the station, came over, gave me a safety brief, and I'm like, yeah, I got it. And then he goes, here's what I really want to tell you, though, and that is, you know, every hour you need to take 10 seconds just look around, because this is this remarkable environment.
Well, I was going to ask you about this, because a lot of your predecessors have said, the one thing I wish I'd done is taken a look and you know, looked at Earth from space, this sort of thing. It's great that he gave you that advice. Had you been, were you mindful of that already? Or did it take that moment?
That was the best advice I've ever gotten, because at the end of an hour, I was on the end of the arm. Janet, who was driving the arm for me, had picked me up out of the payload bay, and we were moving to another position. And at that moment, I actually had 10 seconds. So I just kind of kicked back in my suit and looked past the tail of Atlantis, and there was the Earth just floating by. And I'll never forget that view, because what you can see with your eye is so much more than what you can see with any imaging system. It's incredible. And I actually had an echo of that one recently. As you know, Atlantis has been put in retirement, and it's now down at Kennedy Space Center, and the folks in the Visitor Center put it on display. And so she's there with her payload bay doors open, as only we saw her in space, which is pretty spectacular. And then there's a light wall behind it. It's a projection of LEDs, and right behind the Atlantis, as you come out, you look up past the tail of Atlantis, and there's the Earth going by. And that was almost exactly what I saw when I was outside doing that first spacewalk. So if you ever get to Florida and you want to see what that was like,
you can
drop in and come take a look at that.
And you've brought a little bit of kind of edibles in here. This is the kind of food that you would take with you on a mission?
Yeah, in fact, we have a pretty wide variety of foods in space. In fact, just about anything you and I would eat here on the ground, with a few exceptions, one of them being bread, because it generates crumbs. And so, of course, you don't want that going into computers and equipment. So we take tortillas and Mexican flatbread, which actually works really well. But we have some others, and pretty much everything is dehydrated. So I'll give you a chance to take a look at some of this stuff. There's a breakfast item here, which would be oatmeal, and then we have green beans and mushrooms with a cream sauce. And as you can tell, they're dehydrated, very light. And we'll put a few ounces of water in there, and then after about 15 minutes, they rehydrate. And if you want it hot, you know, we use hot water. We also have a little oven on board, and it works really well. In fact,
did you have a favorite, James, when you were up there? Was there something that you particularly looked forward to in these many hours?
Yeah, there was.
was it the green bean and mushrooms? Looks pretty. I think that would look pretty tasty.
That one actually is very good. Yeah. One of the other things too is your tastes change a little bit in space, and so oftentimes the food that we would have in space are actually going to be a little more spicy than what we would have here on the ground.
And I see this comes in English and Russian.
Yes, in fact, that one's designed for the space station, so we have both English and Russian inventory names on each of these items, And as you can see, they're barcoded. So we keep track of what's up there and what needs to go on the next inventory.
James F. Riley, it's been an absolute pleasure to welcome you here to Midori House. Thanks very much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly.
Thanks very much for having us.
How exciting was that?
What a show.
I feel we have quite literally explored new horizons on the Monocle Weekly.
We have. JR is cool. That's the sticker I'm going to get on my bumper.
We love him.
We do. We never do this, but we said to him, can we come and have our picture taken with you? So we've had our picture taken. He signed photos with him in a space suit. Ah, that was the best.
He was a real pro. And one of the most sort of arresting thoughts that I've ever heard in my whole time on Monocle 24 was him describing looking from the, you know, from that arm where he was doing his spacewalk, looking back at Earth, sort of drifting by. Incredible.
Yeah, and what I also liked was, you know, yeah, here was a gentleman talking about planning, thinking ahead, how he could go into space for months and months and have everything organised. You lost your script straight away afterwards. The photographer didn't put the battery on the camera. I don't think any of us are kind of destined
through,
for space.
Through day one of Spaceman School. Never mind. But what a show it was. And that's all we have time for. It was edition 298 of the Monocle Weekly.
Two more to go and then the cake.
the big 300. We should thank our producer and other associates, shouldn't we, Andrew?
I'm going to thank Tom Hall, who produced the show this week.
And I'll thank our studio managers, plural, because it was a multifaceted effort. Wei Donglin and Claire Urban amongst them.
Well, the Monocle Weekly will be back next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Tuck.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Cheerio.